Okay, we're now going to continue and talk about the financial instruments with characteristics of equity. And I believe I'm going to turn over to Yuni, the ISB staff.
Yeah, so we have 1 hour to share between us and the FASB. And my name is Yuni Choi. I'm a technical staff at the ISB, and I'll be taking you through the ISB project on this subject, Agenda Paper 5A. And in the second half, Mary will take over and take us through the FASB project on this subject. I'm also joined by Rihanna today, who leads the financial instruments accounting team and oversees all financial instruments accounting projects. So if you turn over to slide 3, the objective of the session today is for us to provide an overview of the proposals in the discussion paper published in June last year, and also to provide an overview of the feedback that we received from the stakeholders on the proposals. And we would be happy to clarify any questions and provide any additional information if anyone has questions about our project. And we would particularly like to hear from FASB board members if they have any observation they would like to share based on their own experience. I will pause from time to time after each section to take questions and for board members to provide any observations. So on slide 4, we would like to provide project objective and timeline. So the objective of our project is to improve the information that companies provide in their financial statements about financial instruments that they have issued, and also to address challenges that arise when applying the existing IFRS standard on this issue, IAS 32. And where are we in terms of project lifecycle? This project is a research project on the board's agenda at the moment, and the discussion paper was published mid last year, and the board is currently in the process of analyzing the feedback that we have received. And in the second half of this year, the board will be asked to make a decision on the project direction. And on slide 5, before we get into the details of the proposals in the discussion paper, let me just clarify what is in the scope of our project. So this is about classifying financial instrument as financial liabilities or equity, and includes derivatives on equity as well as non-derivative instruments. But the board is not reconsidering, as part of this project, accounting for financial assets or recognition or measurement requirements, which is covered in IFRS 9, and the board is not reconsidering existing disclosures for financial assets and liability in IFRS 7. And as shown in slide number 7, you will see the discussion paper has 3 parts, basically, classification, presentation, and disclosure. And as with any other project, the board's starting point was to identify what challenges and problems exist when applying the existing IFRS standards. And many of the classification challenges arose because IAS 32 does not provide clear underlying principles. And if you look at IAS 32, it has a list of classification requirements which work well for most financial instruments. However, it does not always explain why the classification requirements work in the way they do and what they are designed to achieve. And sometimes the relationship between different requirements are not clear. And in some cases, depending on which requirement that you apply or which requirement that you apply first, you could get to different classification answers. And because of this lack of underlying principle, the many questions were submitted to Interpretations Committee, but the committee members were not able to conclude based on the existing words in IAS 32, which in turn led to accounting diversity. So what the board has done as part of the discussion paper is to provide clarified principles for classifying financial instruments as liabilities or equity, which will address accounting diversities that exist in practice today, but also be able to address potential classification questions that could arise in the future as financial innovation continues. But the board was also mindful of the fact that IS32 work well for most financial instruments and therefore try to limit changes to classification outcomes that are well understood today. Another problem that exists today is once a financial instrument is classified as an equity instrument, there are limited information provided in the financial statement, and that is because there are much lighter disclosure requirements that apply for equity instruments compared to financial liabilities. And to address that challenge, the board recognized that classification being a binary distinction can provide only so much information regardless of where you draw the line. So the board has just decided to use presentation and disclosure as additional means to provide more information that are not captured by classification alone. So what is the classification principle? So that is shown on slide number 8. And in a nutshell, it involves asking two questions. So if you have issued a financial instrument, you will be asking these two questions. And if you answer yes to both or one of the questions, what you have issued would be classified as financial liabilities. The first one is called a timing feature question, and it is about whether the issuer has an obligation to transfer cash or another financial asset before liquidation. And in the board's view, that is important because in assessing how this financial instrument affects the entity's liquidity and cash flows. The other question that we have on the other side is amount feature question, and it is about looking at what is the amount obligation that issuer has promised when issuing that financial instrument, and whether that amount is independent of the issuer's available economic resources. So if the issuer has promised to deliver a fixed amount, that will be an example of an amount that is independent of the issuer's economic resources. And that question is important to investors assessing whether the financial instruments, how that financial instrument issued by the company affects the solvency of the company, and whether the company has generated enough returns to satisfy the claim that it has promised. For derivatives, the questions are asked in a slightly different manner, as we will see later in this presentation, but the core idea is still based on the same two features, timing and the amount. If you turn over to slide 9, this table shows the result of applying the two questions on classification principle. And what the board recognized there is that not all liabilities are the same. Some liabilities result from answering yes to both of the questions that we just looked at, but there are liabilities that only have one of the two features that we just looked at. In particular, if you look at the top right-hand quadrant, the type of liability that's in blue, that type of liabilities have the amount feature that is similar to an equity instrument, but they are classified as financial liabilities because it has obligation to transfer cash. The board's proposal there is to present income and expenses from this type of financial liability in other comprehensive income so as to allow investors to distinguish the cost of issuing this type of financial liability from other types of financial liabilities. And for the equity instrument, the proposal was to provide more information by attributing total comprehensive income to different classes of equity on the face of financial statements. So for example, if there are preference shares, to show the dividends paid on preference shares separately from those paid on ordinary shares. And a similar idea would apply to derivative equity instruments, to show the value transfer between the existing shareholders to the potential shareholders. And on slide number 10, the discussion paper proposed three disclosure proposals: priority, maximum dilution of ordinary shares, and terms and conditions that are relevant to understanding the timing and the amount of cash flows of financial liabilities and equity instruments. So I will pause here for a moment to take any questions or hear any comments.
Hal?
I'm going to focus just a moment on slide 10. You have a priority on liquidation.
Right.
What was the thought process of liquidation, which is, to me, a little inconsistent with your classification, which is based on other approaches, like your timing features? Seems like a disconnect between those two. Did you consider not liquidation, but expected payout or expected, and what were the trade-offs there?
So the idea was that how the board started this project is firstly identifying what are the important features of financial instrument that investors need to understand. So the features identified there were the timing feature and the amount feature and the type of resources that is required to be transferred, and the last one that would consider is the priority of financial instruments. So the decision made there was to provide information about the timing and the amount feature using the classification, and a priority which is not captured through classification would be provided using disclosure as the means of providing information around that. So I think you are right. We don't consider priority for classifying financial instruments, but because of that, disclosure requirements were developed to provide information around priority.
I think Carl was asking a slightly different question, which is, in theory, we could have asked about priority in the sort of normal course,
right,
or priority in liquidation, and which was liquidation.
More,
why did we go with that?
Which would have seemed more consistent with the classification methodology.
I agree, and I think probably the reason why we did it this way was because arguably in liquidation would be the only point in time when the priority really kicks in, when you can look at everything being due at once, because otherwise things are sort of due at other times. So I think it's just a convenient snapshot. But you're right, there is a bit of a disconnect between the two views.
I guess the other part is more of a cost-benefit question for you. We looked at this, I don't know, three years ago, at providing some priority. And we spent a good bit of time talking to the data aggregators, and they have developed methodologies in their data aggregation databases to give you the priorities, the waterfalls, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm assuming, well, I shouldn't assume, is this disclosure intended to be instrument by instrument, or is it in broad category? Because, the databases that we looked at, it's instrument by instrument, which is a fairly complex waterfall. And I'm wondering, to what degree are you trying to mimic what is out publicly available, I say publicly, through paid services, what's available versus some higher level kind of snapshot, generalized approach, and how will you assess the cost benefit? Because if you're investing in an individual instrument that's in the waterfall, you want to know exactly where you are relative to, other instruments and what they're being priced at in the market. A more generalized approach, I'm questioning who that will be beneficial to. So I'm just trying to understand the cost-benefit thought process that you all went through.
I think the board acknowledged that the level of aggregation would be a challenge, but there were no firm decision made on exactly at what level the information should be disclosed, because at this stage we just wanted to test the idea to see whether investors would find this disclosure useful before discussing and deciding exactly at what level of aggregation will be useful. But clearly, we've heard from investors that getting the right level of aggregation is very important, because, as you said, it has to be sufficiently granular to be useful, but at the same time, they do not like disclosure overload to be a problem.
You may want to talk to our staff that did the homework on this particular area.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what they would tell you is that if you're higher up in the capital stack, this will not, it'll be too general and it won't provide you any benefit. Maybe a good quick index or reference. And if you're lower in the stack, it won't be as important to you.
Correct.
What the order is above you, it's really where you are at the bottom of the stack. So you may want to talk to our staff on this and what we learned. And this is going back about, I think it was about 2 years ago.
We were just talking about this topic last week.
I
shared a copy of the exposure draft, and we were just starting to talk about what we've done versus what's being proposed. We can continue that discussion behind the scenes.
And we spent a good bit of time with the data aggregators talking and what was available. It was fascinating.
All right. So The next section is about what we have heard on the proposal. So if you look at slide number 12, this was a very high-level snapshot of where the respondents were on various different key components of our discussion paper proposals. And green indicating broader support, and red indicating the opposite, and the amber meaning partial agreements or mixed views expressed by the respondents. And in a moment, we will look at more details behind this, but just to clarify, if you look at classification box, there were broad support for the timing features, the one part of the question that we will that was proposed, but there were concerns expressed by the other part of the question, which was the amount feature, so mixed views over there. And if you turn over to slide number 13, the discussion paper asked the question to respondents whether standard setting is required to address the known challenges. And the answer to that we have heard from most respondents were yes. But what the standard setting should be, there were a wide variety of different views, and many prefer targeted improvements to IS32 to address application challenges rather than introducing what they perceive as new set of principles. But there were others who prefer the more fundamental rethinking to develop an approach that could be used to distinguish all types of liabilities from equity, not just financial liabilities. And there were others who prefers targeted improvements, but at the same time acknowledge that targeted improvements or narrow scope amendment cannot resolve all the existing issues. And for that reason, they suggested doing some targeted improvement in the short term, but also as a follow-up or in parallel, the board undertaking more fundamental review to address wider challenges. And there were some who supported the board's preferred approach proposed in the discussion paper, but subject to some modifications, and that the extent of modifications suggested also represented a broad range of different views. And for this session, there are three areas that we'd like to share further details on, and we picked these areas because many respondents told us that these are the areas that they encounter most application challenges, and these are the areas that they would like the board to address. But also we thought these areas will have more overlap with the FASB project and therefore will be more relevant to this meeting, especially the first and the last of the three. So those three areas are set out on slide 14 to 16. And the first one is the classification of derivatives on non-equity. So if we look at what we have today under IAS 32, it has the fixed for fixed condition. But it contains limited guidance or illustrated example to explain how that requirement should apply. And we understand that there are challenges in practice in relation to how to interpret what fixed mean in the fixed-for-fixed condition. So the discussion paper proposed classification principles that involves two questions, again, the timing and the amount feature. So the first question there would be, can the derivative be net cash settled, looking at whether the issuer can be required to transfer cash or another financial asset? And the second question is looking at whether the net amount, and by that we mean the amount of derivative at settlement date, whether that amount can be affected by any variable that is independent of the entity's available economic resources. So for example, if you have a written call option on shares, and if the strike price is denominated in currency other than the functional currency of the issuer, then that foreign currency represents a variable that is independent of the issuer's economic resources. So that derivative will be considered as, will be classified as financial assets or liability. But there, on the other hand, there could be a variable that could be introduced by an anti-dilution provision, and in that case, you will have to undertake a further assessment to see what is the effect created by the anti-dilution provision in order to determine whether that variable is independent. So what have we heard? Respondents welcomed guidance in this area, but they requested for more example and further clarity. However, the respondents said determining whether a variable is independent or not will require significant judgment, and they were concerned that it could lead to new interpretations issue. So I'll pause here to see if anybody have any observations or questions.
I have a question about timing.
Yes.
In the U.S., we have a net cash settlement notion, and currently we approach it, if there's any scenario that could require it, it's a liability, and we're in the process of proposing a change to that. In your proposal, is it any scenario, or is it only other than remote, or is it probable scenarios, or is it literally any scenario?
So we don't look at probability. So if you can be required to net cash settle the derivative in any scenario, then it will be classified as derivative asset or liability.
As long as it's outside your control.
And people agreed with that?
Does it say there they agree with that? No. Well, did they disagree with it? I don't think they disagreed with it per se, because that's the same as 32 today. So in a sense, it's not a change.
Okay.
Having said that, I think we do have some feedback on contingencies where some would probably prefer that we do think about likelihood. But it wasn't a proposal in the document, and it's not really so much a source of problem today.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe a little bit less focus than it seems to be in terms of what you're looking at.
And then my second question was, with respect to the second criteria, the independent of any economic resource, was the concern there the actual model or understanding the words and how it was described?
I think there is just very little in ICE ready to today to interpret what fixed mean in the fixed or fixed conditions. So I think there are some people who said that we understand what the fixed is trying to get to, but for example, if a question is submitted to the interpretations committee, the committee members can't reach the answer, even if they might have some idea about what the sensible answer might be, based on the words and in the standard, they can't reach the answer.
I think in terms of feedback on the discussion, I think a lot of the feedback we got on this was questions about the clarity of articulation.
Mm-hmm.
So it was worded very sort of carefully, but it is very geeky because we're trying not to make it circular. So this idea of it being independent of the entity's economic resources is sort of code for net assets, because we're trying not to make it circular. And there were questions about how clear that concept was. And I think where people really struggled was, often we use as the example to illustrate this, well, if it was just the value of your derivative on settlement was just changing with your share price, then that would be okay for equity. And they're like, hang on, how did you get from independent of your economic resources to your share price? That's not that direct a link. So, you know, how does that work?
Mm-hmm.
And then I think also, because we said on things like the dilution type features, you know, stop and think about whether it's really independent or not. They're like, well, give me a few more parameters for how I think about that. So I think it was partly words, partly clarity of concept. Mm-hmm. I don't think people disagreed per se with the notion of what we're trying to get at. It's more, okay, if you replace fix for fix, which we all agree red literally just doesn't work because even a share split is a problem,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, we can see why you want to do that. But going all of the way to these brand new words is going to give us a whole load of new questions. And so is it a wise thing to do?
Mm-hmm. Mary?
Well, maybe some context or stepping back a big picture. One of the reasons that we had the two classification, you know, the classification principles looked at the two features, slide 8, you know, the amount and the timing, was that we said, you know, we've got this list of practice issues. We could give an answer to each one of those, but that only answers the questions we have. Wouldn't it be better if we could do an articulation of the underlying principles so that this would help people not just to solve known problems but also future problems, and therefore articulating the amount and timing was our attempt at doing that, and then from that we could, you know, would flow answers to the list of practice questions. But we were trying to do this in a context of a project that we said was not a clean sheet of paper. What should the classification principles be? It was, can we target the problem areas? And so some of the feedback we heard was, I don't see how you get from targeted project to articulating the timing and amount without rewriting the whole of 32. So even if you don't intend to change a lot, you're going to have to reconsider everything because it's very different words. And you asked the question, Matt, did we get a lot of pushback on the timing feature? The timing, as Sue said, is consistent with what's in 32 today, and people didn't focus on that. They focused on the amount feature, both, as Sue explained, having trouble with the rather abstract wording of it, mm-hmm. but also questioning whether it was a more fundamental shift in thinking, particularly because if the amount feature, and this you see on the slide 9, even if the amount was only payable in liquidation, if it gave you, inaccurately as a defined amount, but only in liquidation or an accumulating amount, it became liability classified, where today, if it's only payable in liquidation, it wouldn't affect classification. So that I think is at the source of a lot of the pushback on amount feature generally, and you're seeing manifestation on slide 14 when it gets to derivatives in particular.
Okay, Jim.
So I'm particularly interested in the independent of resources and whether that's going to create the same questions as fixed for fixed, because of the question of how independent. So if you say there's anti-dilution, well, that ordinarily would not make something a liability. But if the adjustment gives you a differential return, is that just substitute words for fixed for fixed, or you get paid out time value of your option in the event of a business combination? Is the time value really independent of your resources or not, since it's just a function of running off, well, multiple functions, partly related to volatility, but partly related to interest rates, which probably are independent of your resources. So when you said you're getting requests for more examples, I think that's what our EITF, I suspect, got when we said fixed for fixed. Then they said, well, you can't really mean fixed for fixed, so give us the 10 examples of what you think really is okay. And I wonder, we're struggling with the same thing because we thought about, should we just live with the list that we already have, or should we come up with a principle? And I think the team came up with a couple. Maybe we'll talk about them. But, if the return is highly correlated to your equity return, your common equity, and when we talked to preparers, they said, sounds great, you're going to have to give us the list. And is it the same list as fixed for fixed? So I'm very interested in the feedback, and maybe it helps push us to
Well, I think that
clearer
the feedback that you get on your notion, and I can't remember the words you used, but the link to the sort of
indexation.
Indexation. I think they're quite close cousins. There seems to be quite a lot of overlap. But I think one of the things that we got back as well on our proposals is we thought that it wasn't a big change because the way we were thinking about independent, in our pure, if you asked us the questions, it may not have come through in the words, we thought we were getting to pretty close outcomes to what we would expect from the application of the fixed for fixed requirements in 32 today. But we discovered that the fixed for fixed requirements have become very, because everybody's had to draw a line somewhere that's not strictly fixed for fixed. And over time, I think the stretch has got bigger and bigger. And that's part of what we're having to deal with in the feedback as well.
That's right.
I remember very clearly at an EITF meeting when we had observers back and forth, somebody saying, well, you should just adopt the fixed for fixed principle because it's very clear. And we did, but then we created a bunch of rules.
Yeah.
Yes. So what I will do is I'll cover slides 15 and 16 quickly and then pose for questions and additional observation. So second area that we wanted to share more feedback on is the accounting for written put options on non-controlling interest. And this question arises when an entity has an obligation to repurchase its own equity. But respondents describe the particular application challenge that arises in the context of put options written on non-controlling interest. So if you look at the requirement today, it requires 32 requires recognition of a liability for the present value of the redemption amount and requires reclassification from equity. And that reclassification from equity created accounting diversity because some people interpret it as derecognizing the underlying shares, while the others interpret it as recognizing a debit entry within equity. So the discussion paper proposed pretty much the same accounting for the financial liability piece, but derecognition of equity instrument rather than reclassification. And also to represent the holder's right to keep the shares, the discussion paper proposed to propose recognizing a written call option that represents the holder's right to keep shares by not exercising the put options. So what have we heard? We heard strong support from the respondents for the board to address these issues, but there were mixed views and some concerns expressed about especially the consequences of derecognizing the underlying shares. And they gave us the example of how it would affect the profit and loss allocation to an uncontrolling interest and how it could affect the earnings per share calculation. And although there were no changes proposed, some respondents wanted the board to reconsider or at least deliberate the recognition of the gross financial liability for the redemption amount, because in their view, all derivative on an equity should be treated consistently, i.e. on the net basis. And on slide number 16, that is the disclosure proposal, and we've heard broad support across all respondents' type and particularly strong welcome from investors. And on priority of financial instruments, it was particularly welcomed by debt or fixed income investors, and because they tried to work it out based on limited information available today. And some acknowledge that there will be implementation challenges, especially for multinational group companies. And some also acknowledge that there will be limitation if the information is provided just for financial liabilities and equity instruments. But investors were of the view at least some information is better than none, as long as the limitation or any simplifying assumptions are disclosed clearly alongside the priority disclosure. And on the potential valuation disclosures, it was very popular amongst the equity investors, and because it will help them understand the potential dilution and how the returns are distributed amongst different equity instruments. And thirdly, the terms and conditions, they were popular across all types of investors, but it was highlighted that the level of getting the right level of aggregation will be a challenge. And again, they said it has to be sufficiently granular to be useful, but we don't like the disclosure overload. So some suggestions were made that the scope of this disclosure limited to some complex types of financial instruments, or allowing companies to cross-reference to the information that is disclosed elsewhere, with possible summary of the key features in the financial statement. So, and for the rest of these slides, we have highlighted some key messages that we've heard on other part of the discussion paper proposals, but I will not go through them in the interest of time if anybody has any specific questions. So, I will pause there.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes, thanks, Russ. So next, I'll go through the FASB's project. I'll start with a little bit of an overview about our project objective and scope, and then walk through the tentative decisions as well as some of the basis for the decisions to date. So on slide 2, we have some background on this area. It's been a troublesome area of GAAP for a while, where we've got a high volume of SEC comment letters. We continuously see it year after year as a leading cause of restatements, and the feedback that we've gotten from our stakeholders is that the guidance is incredibly complex. It's difficult to navigate because we've got, the guidance in various topics. We've got a lot of path dependencies that, you have to make sure you go in the right order, and if you don't go in the right order through the guidance, you're going to have a foot fault and maybe apply the wrong model. And then there's inconsistencies in the guidance because we've got various models that were developed over time, kind of one-off, that create inconsistencies. So in 2015, when FASAC initiated its survey on agenda prioritization, this was prioritized by preparers and practitioners as needing an improvement. And then in 2016, we had our invitation to comment on the agenda consultation, and this was ranked as a first priority by preparers and auditors when we got feedback on that invitation to comment. So in 2017, the board added a project on distinguishing liabilities from equity to its agenda. On slide three, we have an overview of the project objective. The core objective is to reduce cost and complexity in financial reporting while maintaining or improving the quality of the information that's provided to financial statement users. As I mentioned, this has been a troublesome area gap for some time, and we looked back at, what are the different projects we've tried, recently or, in the past decade or so at least. We had a joint project with the IASB. We had a project to rewrite the guidance, so try to put it in a single set in the codification versus various topics. And then we had a narrow project to address a specific instrument, financial instruments with down-round features. So when we thought about this project and the objectives and setting the scope, we decided to focus on targeted improvements and targeted improvements to convertible instruments, so convertible debt and preferred shares, and to contracts in an entity's own equity. So while it's a targeted improvements project, we're targeting kind of big chunks of the model versus targeting specific instruments that we might have tried in the past. So that's kind of the context for the objective. And then on slide four, timeline, as I mentioned, we added this in September 2017. We're complete with our initial deliberations, and we're planning to issue an exposure draft next week is the plan. And it's going to have a 75-day comment letter period, so we'll have feedback before the end of the year, and we'll share that with the board probably in the fourth quarter. So diving into some of the specifics on the existing gap as well as the decisions, on slide six, there's an overview of convertible debt. So the feedback that we got on convertible debt is it's very difficult to navigate and complex. As you can see here, we've got five different models that exist in GAAP. There's inconsistencies in those models. So sometimes we focus on the conversion option. So for example, in model three, the beneficial conversion feature, we value the conversion option first. It's done at intrinsic value, and then we use a residual for the host. But in model two here, cash conversion, we focus on the debt component. We want to get to the debt component at a fair value, and then we're at a residual for the conversion feature, and then we look at fair value. So we've got different measurements that we look at, mostly because these were developed in different times. Intrinsic value was more popular during the beneficial conversion feature guidance, and then more recently we're interested in fair value. And you really get very different accounting depending on what model you fall into. So the proposal and the board's tentative decisions are to reduce the number of models. So looking to the right of the slide, we'll have two models going forward. The first is, we haven't touched derivative accounting, so if something's a derivative, if the conversion feature is a derivative, that's staying intact and you still bifurcate the derivative. But we're collapsing the rest of these models, and we're going to apply the traditional convertible debt model, which is a single instrument type of model. On the next slide on preferred shares, I'm not going to go into this into detail, but it's a similar theme as the convertible debt where we've got multiple models. Here we're, again, collapsing it. We'll have the derivatives model, traditional convertible preferred shares, which is essentially just equity. And then we've got the last bucket is just if you've got a liability classified preferred stock, it follows the convertible debt accounting model because it's liability classified. So overall, on slide eight, we see that this is going to simplify the accounting for convertible instruments. Just by the mere fact of having less models, the accounting should be simpler for preparers, simpler to audit, and simpler for investors to follow. And then there's going to be less bifurcation of conversion features. Really, the embedded derivative is going to be the only conversion feature that's bifurcated. In terms of how we came to this decision, which is a change from prior GAAP and the bifurcation, it was really driven by the feedback from financial statement users. So what we heard pretty consistently is that users are typically going to look at the instrument on a whole basis. They don't separate it into conversion option and host. And they're going to think about whether it's going to be repaid or whether they think it's going to be converted. Then they're going to look at, you know, what the exercise price is versus current price, and they're going to make judgments about that and how they're going to include it in their analysis. And that having the separation is really causing confusion out there, and it's simpler to have a clean starting point, and then they can make their adjustments going forward. What we also heard is that, in particular on the cash conversion model, where we're coming up within kind of a normal borrowing rate, so if I didn't have a conversion feature, what would the interest rate have been? Having that be the interest expense is confusing, and they'd rather have it be closer to the coupon rate and not coming up with that borrowing rate. So then moving on to the derivative scope exception, here I just start with a little bit of background on what this is, because the structure I think is a little bit different from IFRS. So under our derivatives guidance, you have to determine whether a scope exception is met from derivatives accounting, and this applies to freestanding instruments or embedded features that have the characteristics of derivative instruments, but then it also applies to freestanding instruments that could be potentially settled in stock regardless of whether or not that instrument meets the definition of a derivative. On slide 12, this is kind of the consequences of the exception. So for freestanding instruments, if you fail the exception, you end up with derivative accounting. So you liability classify, mark to market, and then there's a whole host of derivative exclosures. If you pass the exception, the freestanding instrument would be equity classified. For embedded features, if you fail the exception, you would bifurcate that feature from the host, and then that feature that was bifurcated would be your derivative that you'd mark to market. And then if you pass the scope exception for an embedded feature, it would just not be separated from the host. You know, the host might be liability classified or equity classified, but there's no separate accounting for that feature. On slide 13, this summarizes current GAAP. So the scope exception that I mentioned has two criteria to be met. So we have the indexation criteria, and we have the equity classification criteria. The guidance is very complex and very rule-driven today. You can't factor in any probability. It's very, very strict. So on the indexation, we look at whether the feature is going to settle fixed for fixed. And there's examples that kind of illustrate what we mean by fixed for fixed. And I think as we hit on earlier, nothing is truly fixed for fixed. So what are the things that are okay? How far can we stray from that principle? And then on the equity classification criteria, which focuses on settlement, we look at whether the entity has the ability to share settle the instrument or feature. And then we have seven conditions that we have you're required to look at to see if you're really, it's kind of like, are you really going to cash settle? So it kind of gets into the nitty-gritty of what's in my control and what if I have to have registered shares or, you know, what if there's contingent events, how do I think of those? These two criteria get reassessed every reporting period. So if you have changes in whether you meet the criteria or not, you could have reclassifications between equity and liability. And there's no limit on how many reclassifications you can have. You look at it each period. In terms of the tentative decisions to date in our proposals, we've got those on slide 14. To summarize, you know, one of the biggest items is we're eliminating the need to evaluate remote events in both the indexation and the settlement criteria. So we expect that this is going to reduce the form-driven accounting conclusions. So today you could have some remote feature in there that's driving the accounting for the entire instrument. So this will take some of the tension off of that. In terms of the settlement criteria, we're removing three of the conditions for equity classification. Two of those conditions are unrelated to cash settlement, so it's whether you have to post collateral and whether you know, the rights of the instrument holder are different from shareholder rights. So we took those out to kind of clean up the conditions and really link them back to the principle about settlement. And then we took one of the conditions out to align with guidance that we have in share-based payments, and that relates to whether or not the instrument can settle in registered shares or not, or whether it could settle in unregistered shares. And we heard from stakeholders that that's one of the most difficult aspects of the guidance to apply, and it is inconsistent with other areas of GAAP, so we've cleaned that up. And then lastly in this area, we've changed the frequency of the reassessment. So as I mentioned on the prior slide, in current GAAP, it's quarterly or every reporting period. When the board thought about cost-benefit and the cost of doing a continuous reassessment and continually reassessing probability, they decided to it's not really going to be cost-beneficial, and it could cause a lot of second-guessing in terms of whether something is remote this period, you know, when does it not become remote, if it's the next period or two quarters, like how do you make that call. So we've reduced the frequency, but we've compensated by adding a new disclosure requirement that includes information about terms that may change the exercise price or may change the number of shares. So while we're not reassessing, there will be some information. So overall, there's a little more latitude for use of management judgment with the introduction of the probability. We've reduced some of the strict rules, and we think that this is going to reduce form over substance classification outcomes. In terms of the basis for the decisions, as I mentioned, reducing form over substance, we won't have these remote features driving the entire accounting for the instrument. And we think this is going to provide relief, in particular for private companies and small public companies that continuously have errors and restatements because of some of these remote features. And then the last section we have here is disclosures and earnings per share. These are follow-ons to kind of the core decision. So as we were thinking about the changes to convertible instruments and the changes to contracts and owner equity, we looked at the disclosures to see if there were any improvements we'd have to make there or any follow-ons, improvements to EPS that we might want to make. So on disclosures, we reviewed all of the existing disclosures for convertible instruments and contracts in an entity's own equity. And the feedback we got is that they're pretty robust. There's a lot of good information. So you'll see on slide 18, we've just made some changes around the fringes, so including some disclosures about conditions that might affect conversion of a convertible instrument, which party controls the conversion, and then, as I mentioned previously, with the reclassifications for contracts and own equity, events that might trigger that. So what are the terms that could cause a reclassification? On EPS, there were two areas we looked at. We looked at convertible instruments and the if-converted method, and then we looked at instruments that could be settled in cash or shares. On convertible instruments, the feedback we got from users and what we saw is that there's different methods used depending on what kind of convertible debt you have. So if you've got most convertible debt is using an if-converted method, which is outlined on the slide, but we've got one convertible instrument that can be cash settled that uses a different method. So we've simply aligned those methods so that all convertible instruments are going to use the if-converted method, and then we've made some minor modifications to the if-converted method to accommodate that instrument. And then lastly on EPS, when you've got an instrument that can be settled in cash or shares, there's guidance in GAAP that tells you how you determine whether or not you include that dilution in EPS. So under current GAAP, you presume that it's going to be share settled, but you can rebut that presumption. And practice is relying on factors that are in a 2003 SEC speech to figure out whether or not you can rebut. So in terms of future GAAP and the board's tentative decisions, we've changed that you can no longer rebut the presumption. And if there's an option to cash or share settle, you presume the shares. So essentially, you include the most dilutive approach in there, and this aligns with IFRS in that respect. So with that, I'll turn to the questions for the board. We'd like to know if there's any additional information that the ISB would like about the FASB's decisions, and then whether there's any feedback about the tentative decisions to date.
Mary?
Tried two observations. One is about the indexation point, one is about bifurcation. The indexation point, and Russ, you know, your initial questions trying to map the two projects kind of brought it out. As I went through this, it was very helpful at pointing out to me that there was a fair amount of overlap between our amount concept and I think the things that you're trying to do with indexation. I think on the one hand, A, you've had it around as a, you know, in it might have been more detailed articulations, but it's been around for a while, and it seems like it's more specific. You know, in this case, or this is an instance of allowable and, you know, not allowable in terms of classification. And I reflect on that because I think we were getting, and I'm looking at Uni for this, pushback at two levels on the amount feature. One was the wording point. Are we sure, you know, we're just going to open a new subdivision to deal with questions around, you know, is how the amount feature applies to this feature or that feature. But the others, I think, some people really questioned a bit more the conceptual validity of amount, particularly when it was amount relating to amounts payable only at liquidation. And so one question I have is whether this payable only at liquidation, you know, how that factors into your model and what kind of feedback you had. And then the other is more an observation, which is about the bifurcation. you had a comment that I think it's slide 9 that users generally analyze the instruments as a whole, and so would prefer almost that you get reduce the amount of bifurcation. And while some of the comments on here I can map to feedback we had, and that includes that some of the more sophisticated users, I think, were interested in knowing what the cash interest paid was. I think overall we didn't hear much, if anything, with people challenging the existing level of separation that we have under IS 32. And when I reflect on the overall tone of the comments, there's, a pretty high level of concern about dilution and not understand, not having enough information about dilution and not wanting to just get it via a computation in earnings per share. So in some ways, the separation and recognition of either a derivative or an equity instrument for a convert feature gave recognition and measurement to potential dilution. And so while we didn't get comments on that point because we had a big document, we're asking a lot of other questions, I think overall the concerns they were expressing are more consistent with wanting separation so that you had accounting for the equity ingredient, the equity element of a complex financial instrument, and so that there were more flags and more focus on the potential dilution that those represented. Yeah. So I think that feedback is quite different between what you were hearing and what we've heard, although we didn't have a question directly on that point.
Yeah, so on your first question about liquidation, so in this area of gap on both the indexation and the settlement, it's other than liquidation, what's happening. I think, when we have our going concern basis of accounting and GAAP, you don't really look at if the entity liquidated, what would happen. You presume they're going to be ongoing. So our guidance specifically says that you don't look at what would happen to the instrument in liquidation when determining whether or not it meets the scope exception.
Even if it meant that when it comes to liquidation, somebody could say, hi, I have the golden card. Please give me 85% of your net assets, because now that you're liquidating, I own a lot more than I might look to own today.
I mean, I think it just generally talks about that what happens in liquidation doesn't. I don't have any specific examples. I know in particular on the cash settlement piece, we say you don't think about whether, if it's sure settle, but in liquidation you settle in cash, that doesn't change your classification. And then on the user feedback, I think in terms of the disclosures that we have in current GAAP, there's really extensive disclosures on terms and conditions, and we've looked at a lot of samples and seen pretty extensive what companies are disclosing in terms of how the instruments are structured, what could trigger conversion, what the rates are at, and I think the feedback we got from users is that those disclosures and understanding the instrument is more important to them than the actual numbers that are in the balance sheet today for bifurcation. So they want all the pieces and a simple starting point, and then they can decide how they want to model those out going forward, but really understanding what the instrument is and all the terms and features is really the most important piece of it.
Lloyd?
One observation and one question. So just on the observation front, I don't, on the convertibles and convertible debt, it's interesting to me that we didn't really ask questions on this because we weren't trying to reopen everything, and compounds was sort of okay, so convertible debt, we haven't gone there and proposed any changes from what we have today because it wasn't sort of broken and what we were looking at. But I think philosophically one interesting difference between the approach that you seem to be taking and the approach that we have taken in some aspects is you're focusing on, I think, reducing complexity a lot on this, which is obviously a valid perspective. And I think what we have focused a little bit on in areas where we have touched on this in our discussion paper was more to make sure we didn't have differences in outcome depending on how instruments were sliced and diced. Mm. So we didn't touch compounds, but we have, for example, when we've got to written puts over non-controlling interests, tried to analogize to convertible debt to make sure that sort of similar economics are treated in a similar way. So we'd want to a debt plus a derivative to be treated the same way as a derivative combined with a debt. So it's just a sort of different philosophy which I think is interesting. The question was on the the things that you're doing on the derivatives, which are interesting. So if I understand correctly, you're not proposing to change the indexation criteria per se. The changes are on the other bits.
And indexation, we're just adding the probability. That's the only change.
Oh, yeah. That's what I would call the other bits. So yeah. The indexation criteria per se is the same, mm-hmm. but you're changing the proposing changing the how you think about the likelihood of things occurring and also the reassessment. We don't have reassessment at all, so I think our starting position is slightly different. But I guess my question is, because it's, I'm sure has come up in some of the comment letters that I've read from memory, how have you defined remote?
So what we did is we took remote as already defined in U.S. GAAP, so we thought it would be helpful to take an existing term and apply it here. So rather than creating a threshold, I think we think that remote's understood well in practice as being a pretty... I think it's a slight chance of occurrence is the way it's defined.
It's
a pretty high.
It exists in GAAP today.
Yeah, I'm just interested what it is because I don't know it. So, okay, a slight chance of occurrence. Okay. And then you'd have disclosure. So say, for example, you have somebody who's got an instrument that will, I don't know, act in a particular way if the bank doesn't have enough Tier 1 capital. You'd say, well, you'd have to assess whether you think that's remote or not, and then you'd have disclosure about the fact that if that event occurs, then this would be how the instrument would behave. That's the idea.
That's right. I think the disclosures is a... We're interested in seeing the feedback because it's a fine line of we don't want everyone to disclose every single term, but we want to get kind of the significant terms. So like the case that you just described, I would think would be covered by our disclosure.
And because you already have reassessment in your model, you've already got requirements for how you do the accounting to move things between derivative and not if they change classification. So it's not something you have to introduce. It's already
That's right. Existing. It's already there. So you just change it in the balance. You flip it in the balance sheet, and then the P&L is done prospective. So you don't reverse any prior marks or catch up any marks. Just get the balance sheet right, and then go forward on the new basis.
Yeah. Chung Wu.
Yes, a short question. On that derivative scoping in an exception. Based on your analysis on this slide 12, freestanding financial instruments, if they fail the scope exception, it's classified as a liability. But if it passed the scope exception, it's classified as equity. And also, your current gap is not considering probability, but your future gap will consider, as Susan suggested, that will consider some kind of probability. So based on this whole scenario, you know, if you have this future gap as a you suggest here, then what will be the final classification of this freestanding financial instruments?
So what would happen is you'd pass the scope exception, it would be equity classified.
Classified equity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So today, for example, if you had an instrument that had one remote feature, so it failed the scope exception, it would be a derivative. If now it would pass the scope exception, because you don't have to look at that feature, it would be equity.
Okay.
Jim?
Mary, to your point on bifurcation or the reflecting of the true financing cost, this was one where I was shocked at the feedback because it was before the board decisions and the staff reached out to, I won't get the exact number, but 20-plus investors and illustrated not just the terms and conditions but the resulting accounting. And I think all but one investor said, please don't separate. We don't want to see, I guess, Gary was part of that outreach. He wasn't on the board yet, but he used terms like, you know, bogus interest expense. We want to see cat. It was that pejorative of some of the terms is we don't want to see it. We want to see cash interest expense. We don't want dilution reflected through the P&L. That's not our substitute for how we calculate dilution. And I wanted to head the actual other way, and it was overwhelming in terms of the response.
I'm a little surprised that you're surprised because of the complexities. You get to a point where what I heard from during the outreach was just give us a common, simple starting point for us to understand. We, being the investor, will then assess what we think will happen, and we'll do the work on that path. So it wasn't that it's not educational and informative. I think from a conceptual standpoint, bifurcation makes a lot of sense. But if you're on the other side and you got 150 companies to look at and 20 of them have this type of situation, you can really get lost in the weeds very quickly. So I think the feedback that we were getting is keep it simple, stupid, and just let us figure out when we want to branch off and do a deeper dive.
And the reason I was surprised is I think in the past our feedback on this topic came from accounting users, not users. And accounting users were sort of the one who disagreed was more of an accountant background and said you can't go that way.
It shows the parallels of or the perils of asking an accounting analyst versus someone who's putting money at risk. Yep.
Gary.
Yeah, it's interesting. We talked to the investors on our investor advisory committee, FASAC, and other committees, and you mentioned we have 5 convertible debt models. They give you a quizzical look like, what are you talking about? So to Hal's point, the complexity is overwhelming, so therefore we have excellent disclosures. Our footnote disclosures are excellent. I can look at them and look at the cash interest, I can look at the conversion features. If I'm following a tech or a healthcare company, and to Hal's point, I care about revenues, I care about margin, future product development, I'm going to read the footnote disclosure in about 3 to 5 minutes. What is the conversion impact? How close is it to the conversion price? And I'm going to think about it in terms of, you know, the conversion dilution. All the rest of this is, you know, nice theoretical accounting, but doesn't help me at all.
Anything else on this topic? Okay, great. Great discussion. I understand we've earned the right
lunch,
to eat. Yeah, good.
Should be back at 1:35.
Okay, great.
Time, but...